This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might want to put aside your bottled water as you listen to this next interview. It's all about water, including why bottled water is not environmentally correct. My guest is Peter Glick. He's an expert on sustainable water use, the impact of climate change on water, and conflicts over water resources. He edits the biennial report, The World's Water, is a former MacArthur Fellow, and is the founder and president of the think tank, the Pacific Institute, which is based in Oakland. He says it's time to rethink how we use and conserve water. I ask Glick about the areas with the worst water shortages now in the U.S.
Well, we've traditionally thought that the western United States is the place where our water shortages are the worst. After you get west of the Mississippi River, the U.S. starts to dry out. And we really see and have seen for a century scarcity of water, conflict over limited water resources. The entire Southwest, for example, is pretty much dependent on one big river. That's the Colorado River, and it's not all that big. And so there's been conflict over water availability and water scarcity in the West for many, many years. We have a long history of it here. But increasingly, we're finding that we have water problems elsewhere. The entire Southeast right now is in a very, very severe drought. Atlanta is water short. There's a fight between Georgia and Alabama and Florida over water. We see contamination problems throughout the Northeast. I think water is just it's a resource that we can no longer take for granted anywhere. And I think that's going to be one of the new challenges in the coming decades.
Do you think global warming is affecting water supply?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The evidence, first of all, that climate change is a real problem. And second of all, that it's a real problem because of things that humans are doing. And third of all, that it's already happening is increasingly compelling. We just see more and more evidence that climate change is a real problem and that it's going to get much, much worse. And we see a lot of evidence that, in fact, one of the worst impacts of climate change will be impacts on our water supply, water availability, water quality, water temperature, water timing and distribution, the frequency and intensity of droughts and floods. All of those things are connected to climate.
So you see more drought and more flooding?
Yes, ironically, climate change could have, I guess, caused a better world. It could have made the drier places become wetter and the wetter places become a little bit drier and cold places warmer. But unfortunately, the more we learn about climate change and the more we learn about what the impacts of climate change are going to be, the more bad news we get. It seems as though the drier places are going to get drier just because of the way the world's climate system delivers water. It doesn't deliver water particularly well to dry places. And as the climate changes, that may be worsened. And at the same time, of course, we worry terribly about floods, a tremendous amount of water in a short period of time. And it seems as though the climate cycle is going to intensify. That is, we're going to get more rain where we already get a lot of rain, and it may be condensed into a shorter period of time. So we may unfortunately get both more droughts and more floods. It's sort of the worst of all possible worlds.
Hey, thanks for the good news. Now, one of your major points is that we have to stop thinking about water in the way that we thought about it in the 20th century. The emphasis in the 20th century was on what?
Well, in the 20th century, we built, especially in the United States, but this is true worldwide, we built a tremendous amount of physical infrastructure. We built dams to capture water in the wet season so we could use it in the dry season. We built reservoirs and aqueducts so that we could move water from where we get it to where we want it, from wet places to dry places. And that infrastructure, that hard path, as I've described it, brought enormous advantages to us, enormous benefits to us. It was a wonderful thing. We eliminated water-related diseases in this country pretty much. We used to suffer terribly in the United States from cholera and dysentery and typhoid and all of those diseases that we associated with lack of safe drinking water. And mostly those completely disappeared in the early part of the 19th century and the later part of the 19th century when we built that infrastructure. But the opportunities to build new dams and new reservoirs is pretty much gone. We've built on the good dam sites and unfortunately some of the bad dam sites as well. And we're going to have to rethink the way we use the existing resources we have. There may be places to build new infrastructure, But I actually think the 21st century is going to be, in the United States especially, a century of water management and smart use and rethinking allocations of water from one user to another and figuring out how to use the infrastructure we built better.
One of the more surprising things I learned in reading about you is that although we're having a water crisis in parts of the United States, we actually use less water per person and less water in total than we did 25 years ago. I find that kind of shocking.
It's shocking, perhaps not just to you, but interestingly enough, to many people who work in the water area. The fundamental assumption that we train our engineers and we train our hydrologists and we train our water managers to assume is that as population grows and our economy grows, the demand for water must inexorably also grow. And in the past, that's been pretty much true. As our population, as our economy grew, the demand, our withdrawals of water grew as well, exponentially. Up until, interestingly enough, around the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then those two curves split apart. And today, in the United States, we actually use less water for everything, for drinking, for cleaning, for flushing our toilets, for irrigation, for cooling our power plants, than we used 20 years ago. And per person, we use a lot less water than we used 20 years ago. We broke that link. And even today, most water planners don't know that. And they continue to assume, and this is part of this 20th century mentality that I think has to change, they continue to assume that a healthy economy and a growing population means we have to tap more and more into our, frankly, limited water resource.
What accounts for the fact that we're using less water per person than we used to?
In the 1980s, we had an energy crisis. Actually, in the late 70s, we had a series of energy crises. And we also had a series of environmental crises. I don't know if you recall, but the Cuyahoga River caught fire in the late 1960s. Lake Erie was dying. Water pollution was horrible in the United States because we had no controls whatsoever on the kinds of things we put in our wastewater, and we dumped them into our rivers and streams without really consideration for the environment. That was a time when we passed our first national environmental laws. We passed the Clean Water Act, and we passed the Safe Drinking Water Act. And one piece of that required industry to, for the first time, not dump untreated wastewater into our rivers and streams. And it turns out that one of the best ways to cut down on wastewater is to simply use less water in the first place. Rather than produce a lot of wastewater and treat it, which is very expensive, if you can figure out how to produce less wastewater, then you save money and you meet these federal standards that are very important to us. That was the first reason that industry started to look at ways to save water, to use water more effectively. And let me give you actually a good example. In the 1930s in the U.S., it took 200 tons of water to make a ton of steel. By the 1980s, the steel industry had gotten that down to about 20 tons of water to make a ton of steel, partly because they were trying to figure out how to meet these wastewater rules. Today, the most efficient steel plants in the world use only 3 or 4 tons of water to make a ton of steel. That's a 98-99% reduction in the water requirement to make steel. And that's part of what's going on in this trend toward water use efficiency. We're getting smarter at doing what we want to do and figuring out how to do it with less water.
Do you feel like individuals are getting smarter, too, and using water in their homes and offices?
I do. If you think about how we use water in our homes, it turns out the largest single user of water in our homes is our toilets. And before 1994, almost all the toilets sold in the United States used 6 gallons every time we flushed them. And more than a decade ago, in 1994, the federal government changed the standard to 1.6 gallons per flush. And that's a 75% reduction just in the amount of water to flush toilets. But we've also improved our shower heads. Our front-loading washing machines are much more water efficient than they used to be, than the old top-loading washing machines. Basically, all of the forms of appliances that use water are more efficient today than they used to be. And You know, heaven knows there's still plenty of horrible, inefficient toilets and washing machines and showerheads out there. And that's actually a good thing in that it offers us some opportunities to improve our efficiency even more. But we're becoming more efficient. We're doing what we want with less water.
If we've cut back on water per person, why are we experiencing a shortage of water? Why is it more of a problem than it was, say, 25 years ago?
There are a couple of reasons for that. One is nature gives us water in different times and different places in different amounts. And the southeastern United States is in a very severe drought right now, as is the southwestern United States. So there are times when nature just doesn't give us very much. So I would say our concerns about water scarcity are a combination of natural variability, a combination of the fact that climate change is increasingly putting pressure on our water and water scarce areas, and on the fact that our populations have grown in places where water is very short. And so the little bit of slack that we might have had in dry areas like the Southwest is gone. We've over-allocated the rivers that are there. We've given away more water than nature is going in the long run to reliably provide for us.
Now, a lot of people are drinking bottled water. There's the big gallon jugs, and then there's the little bottles that people walk around drinking. You don't really like the idea of bottled water. What's the problem with it?
Well, I don't really like the idea of bottled water. I love the idea that in the United States, we can get high-quality potable water from our taps for incredibly low cost. That fact is the reason why we don't have water-related diseases in the United States, which are so rampant still in much of the rest of the world. We invested 100 years ago in our municipal water systems, and we invested in high-quality tap water. And I worry about bottled water and the perception that our tap water isn't good, a perception that is unfortunately often encouraged by advertising for bottled water. I worry about the energy cost of bottling water. I worry about the plastics involved in bottled water. I understand completely that bottled water is very convenient. There are times when I will admit to buying bottled water when I have no other choice, something my friends are probably going to be horrified to hear. But it's a luxury, and it's a luxury we don't really need for the most part. I'm not saying we shouldn't have bottled water, but I really do believe people ought to understand what, first of all, high-quality tap water is available to them, and second of all, what the true costs of bottled water are.
Well, let's talk about those true costs. Am I right in saying it takes 3 liters of water to produce 1 liter of bottled water?
Well, interestingly, it takes 3 liters of water to produce the plastic bottle that holds a liter of bottled water.
Oh, I see.
Bottled water, of course, mostly comes in plastic in the United States, PET plastic, which is recyclable, although rarely recycled. And it takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of water to make the plastic itself. So probably if you include the liter of water that's in the bottle, it probably takes 3 to 4 liters of water to make a liter of bottled water.
How much oil does it take?
Well, we actually estimated this, not including the energy to cool the bottle in the store or to move the bottle from the bottling plant to where it's sold, just the energy involved in making the plastic and in actually bottling the water itself. We estimated was the equivalent of about 17 million barrels of oil a year in the United States for the 8 billion gallons of bottled water that we drink every year.
You've pointed out that we don't need potable water to flush toilets or to water lawns. So what kind of alternatives do you see? How would we be able to use non-drinkable water for things like watering lawns or flushing toilets?
Yeah, that's a great point and a very important idea. Again, in the 20th century, we built this water system, and it brings incredibly high-quality potable water to our homes. And we use it to drink and to flush our toilets and to water our lawns. It's a crazy use of a wonderful resource. And so one of the things that people are thinking about in the coming years is ways of using non-potable water for non-potable purposes. In new homes, for example, increasingly we're seeing homes that are what are called dual-plumbed, They have two sets of pipes. One brings high-quality potable water to our faucets, and the other brings fairly high-quality but not necessarily potable water, sometimes treated wastewater, to flush our toilets and to use on our lawns where we don't need potable water. It's expensive to do in homes that are already plumbed, but it's not as expensive to do in new developments where we have access to two different sources of water. We're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see more and more use of treated wastewater on golf courses for industrial uses that don't require potable drinking water. I think figuring out how to match the quality of the water that we have with the quality of water in the different uses that we need is part of this new thinking for the 21st century.
What do you think about desalinization, taking seawater, using a process that gets the salt out of it so it can be drinkable and used for other purposes?
It's ironic that we live on a planet that seems to be covered in water, to be talking about water problems. And 98% of the water on the planet is salt water. It's the salt water in the oceans. And for centuries, we've looked at that water and we've thought, if only we could figure out how to make that salt water fresh, then our problems would be solved. And the truth is, we know how to make that salt water fresh water. It's called desalination or desalinization or desalting. There are many technologies that have been used for decades now to make fresh water out of salt, But the challenge is still that it's very, very expensive. It takes a lot of energy to strip salt ions out of salt water. And the energy costs alone make the price of desalinated water way beyond anything farmers would be able to afford, for example. So I think that we're going to see more and more desalination. I think we're already seeing it expanding fairly rapidly in places that don't have any alternative and have a lot of energy, like the Persian Gulf, for example. But in the United States, we still have less costly alternatives. It's less costly to use water that we already pay for more efficiently. It's less costly to figure out how to use water more effectively in agriculture and send some of that water to the cities. We are seeing a little bit of desalination. There's a new plant in Florida, in Tampa Bay. There are proposals for plants in California for very high-valued municipal uses. So I do think we will see desalination in the United States, but I think it will be a relatively small part of the solution for some time to come.
You've consulted to a lot of cities, and you did an analysis of Las Vegas's water problem. Las Vegas is a desert town with a booming population and a lot of water problems. I'm wondering, you know, you made your recommendations and everything, but I'm wondering if you think that places like Las Vegas should exist in the first place. If you think there should be booming cities and places that are hard to sustain in terms of water because they're in a desert.
Well,
not that they asked you and it's a little too late, but
yeah, if they had asked me, I might have made a recommendation in that regard, but it's too late. We have built our cities in the desert. We've assumed that we could do whatever we want and we'll find the water. We'll move the water there. This is the way Las Vegas was developed. It was the way Los Angeles was developed, Phoenix, Tucson. We built cities in the desert. I don't know why people love to live in really hot, dry places, but they do. And in the past, the answer has been build it and we'll figure out a way to get the water there. And that worked to some degree in the 20th century, but it's not going to work in the 21st century. There isn't any more water. We're at our limits. We're at the limits of our resources here, and we're not going to go to Canada or Alaska. We're not going to desalinate seawater infinitely and move it to Las Vegas. It's too far and too expensive. And so the idea that we can grow without thinking about the resources that are available for that growth is an old idea, and it's not going to work any longer. It's time that we integrated the concept of growth and concerns about growth with decisions about water and frankly, energy and all of the other resources that we use. We can't grow infinitely without running up against limits. And in places like Las Vegas, those limits are pretty apparent already.
Well, Peter Glick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Peter Glick is the president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland and edits the biennial report, The World's Water.